While we're gathered here, we discussed a couple of our meetings about needing some training, and we have our legal counsel, Mr. Rich, here. Dave is going to bring us up to speed on some of this. We're going to be starting out with Planning Commission hearing protocol and hearing processes.
Maybe before I start on that, I wanted to go through some items that we attached to packets that you were given tonight. We did email those ahead of time and also putting them together today. Just some background information. And we've got, let's see, Exhibit A, outline of our workshop today. Exhibit B, Robert Tool's order, parliamentary procedure, some background reading on that. In case you're having trouble getting to sleep tonight. Exhibit C, Robert Rules of Order for Beginners, a little easier to digest. And how you agree. Then another one called Simplified Robert Tools of Order. You can pick your favorite, I guess,
of Robert Tools of Order for Dummies. Have you done that?
I did have that, but I decided not to do it. I refrained.
We also have a summary version of the Rules of Order, a cheat sheet, that's again enough. Our guide to parliamentary motions, and these are all labeled as exhibits. Get your way through them. They came from different publications, so we didn't want to repaginate them all, so we just put exhibit numbers on. A quick reference guide, Oregon Public Meeting Law, is exhibit I. And where did you pull that one from?
This one, it was off of the internet. I just went in and put Oregon's public meeting law. So there were several different things. This one I thought was the board has sent this one over to me at other times, so I thought I would use that one. And then the second one here is a little more, is from Department of Justice, and it was a little more in detail.
Okay.
So that's why I did both. I did want to mention, if I may, this Robert's Rules in short, which is Exhibit H. I pulled it off of the Attorney General out of Madison, Wisconsin. So the first page or two mentions some of the things of their rules for Madison, but the rest of it was really a nice summary of, you know, the motions and everything. So that's why I put that one in there.
And then moving through this on Exhibit K, we've got the Board of Commissioners for Josephine County, Board Order Number 2005-021, alternate voting. We had some questions about that. You'll recall in a hearing we had recently, when an alternate steps in, is it only due to lack of quorum, or is it a more literal reading of this resolution, which says, unless said alternates, the non-voting elected is substituting for an absent area commission member. And Steve here with his guidance, perhaps we can talk about what does that mean, and let's just confirm this for all of us so we know exactly what that means. We've got a commission member absent, the alternate step in, or is it only a line of quorum? And that was the issue that we started with last time. And then Exhibit L are a couple of ORSs regarding membership of the Planning Commission. It's an issue that Doc wanted to cover that was supposed to have a particular makeup of the group, and that's in the ordinance by staff. So we're going to talk about that a little bit. Or at least, if we don't get to that tonight, have that information in front of you so you can have that as background material. And then perhaps in a future session, we can answer questions if you have them. Those are those materials. And with that, we'll turn to Exhibit A, which is the workshop. Flushed out the bullet points that you saw on the agenda. This is the workshop items. Quorum. Everybody pretty clear on what a quorum is? You have nine members on your commission?
Yes.
Your quorum has to be five.
So we have eight.
No, we have eight right now, and
Ann tells me that we have an alternate and a regular commission member that have been appointed, or
they have been, they will be appointed. They have been designated. They
scheduled
will be
for an appointment next Wednesday.
I believe next Wednesday. I'm not sure. I just haven't seen their agenda yet.
Okay.
But having eight tonight, our quorum is still five.
Yes.
Alternate voting in place of absent member.
Steve, you've read the board.
I have read the board. What do you think? I will tell you this. The board has a lot of flexibility to interpret their own orders and their own ordinances, especially in the land use context. And nobody's going to argue with them what they say. This is what we think it means. If that issue has never been directly addressed by the board, then we're left until they do so, if they choose to do so, say, okay, basically this is our best guess.
As a commission.
As a commission, that's basically what you have to do. Once you decide, okay, the board hasn't weighed in on this, we have, then I would encourage you, whichever way you decide to go, to stick to that, to follow that precedent. So while we might be wrong, at least we've been consistent. And that's better than just, you know, kind of saying, well, this week we're going to do it this way, and next week we'll do it a different way, something else. Because it simply is, as a matter of fairness, the participants need to understand, you know, what's going on and what their expectations of them might be. I don't want to step over the bounds or step outside of your outline here, but I did want to make a couple of comments before I forget them. And one of them was on some training that Dave and I went to today regarding the Ethics Commission. I wanted to remind you all that you're all public officials, and so you're subject to the Ethics Commission. And one of the things that I don't often think about is that in the context of a planning commissioner, it's a little different. That the trainer, the person that is employed by the Ethics Commission, said, planning commissions give me a headache because there are all kinds of special rules for planning commission. I'm not going to relate a 3 or 4 hour program to you in a couple of minutes, but you need to remember that in your role as a planning commissioner, you're going to have an overlay of consequences if you violate for example, the conflict of interest rules. Conflict of interest rules will not only create an appealable issue in the land use context, but they will subject you to fines for being in violation of that. And there was two specific items that were pointed out as applying only to planning commissions. No other board has this requirement. The planning commissioners may not participate in any action where any of the following have a direct or substantial financial interest. And remember, conflicts of interest in the Oregon definition mean financial. If you are in love with an applicant, that may be bias, but it's not potential anyway, a conflict. So keep the distinction between conflict, and that's important because a conflict will create financial liability for you, and a bias just gets the case reversed at LUBA.
If they have to be living with that person.
Yeah, if you have to be living. Then there's another problem. But it says you must publicly announce potential conflicts, of course, and if it's an actual conflict, you cannot participate. But the things that will trip most of us up is the peculiar definitions that they use when they start talking about your family. Because that, of course, would involve your spouse. It involves your brother, your sister-in-law, but also your brother-in-law, and your father-in-law, and your mother-in-law. And if you don't know, but you know that they own property someplace over next to a particular application that's going on, you potentially then have an obligation to check that out and disclose whether that's an issue or not.
Did you say they don't know they have property?
No, if you know that they have.
Okay, yeah.
If you don't know, you don't know.
Okay, good.
So, and it says any business with which the member is negotiating, let me back up. So if you include all those family things as to how far the net goes out, there's two things. Any business in which the member of the Planning Commission, any business that you are then serving or have served in the previous 2 years. So if you worked for some store or business a year and a half ago, and they come in with an application, and you think, oh, I don't have a conflict with them because, you know, they fired me and I didn't ever like them anyway. If it's within a two-year period, you got a conflict. So, in fact, I reminded somebody on the way to the training that, you know, the words that they use oftentimes are counterintuitive. It's like ethics from a government standard and practice issues. Is that about doing what's right or wrong, or moral or immoral, or righteous or evil? It's about following these rules, and they can be pretty unforgiving. And if you have, if you're involved with a business that you're negotiating, purchase the business or the property or anything else, or you have an arrangement or an understanding concerning potential, then even if that falls through, you would probably need to disclose that before you take any action. Nobody else is subject to those, and I just thought I'd mention it as something to keep an eye out for if you have any of those kind of contacts, because, as I say, a conflict issue will create financial, monetary fines potentially for you.
Steve, can I ask a question?
Sure.
I heard you mention potential conflicts. I think you're probably the one that gave the city, maybe you weren't. I have been advised when I was asked if I would serve on the UGP steering committee. I said, I've got a conflict of interest. I don't think I can do it. And they went and talked to some lawyer, I don't know who, and said, no, you only have a potential conflict of interest because you won't be voting. You'll only be on the committee. And because you're not voting, it's on. Every time we have a meeting, I have to state I have potential conflict of interest. I have property that may or may not be included in the UGB.
Yeah. With a potential conflict of interest, you must disclose it, state the nature of the potential conflict, but then you can participate. If you have an actual conflict, you can't participate, you can't discuss, you can't vote.
But it seems to me I've still got a conflict because everything I do could be construed that I'm trying to make my property more valuable by getting into the UGB.
Well, remember what I said about counterintuitive language?
Yeah.
It's potential, so the only thing you have to do is disclose.
Okay.
So, no, that doesn't keep you from saying, you know, I don't want to do it because I don't like the way it looks or I don't want to be that close.
Yeah.
But it's not a violation of either planning rules or the government ethics rules.
It's strictly because of the voting aspect, and it's, I gather, right? Because I'm just a liaison.
Well, even if you were voting, you wouldn't have a conflict. Let me rephrase. You would have a potential conflict. And the only thing you're required to do with a potential conflict is disclose.
Well, why is it potential and not conflict then? Because I do have a financial interest in this.
Because it's potential. You may not be included.
But then if I vote to include it, does that become a conflict?
Well, can you control that? I mean, if you were to break a tie to include your property in, you know, then maybe you would.
Just abstain from the vote.
By disclosing it, Malcolm, you may end up pulling that piece of property out of a vote where you don't participate, and you leave the room or go sit down in the audience, and then
individual properties is different districts that are being considered.
Right. So there's different ways there. Not to be a dead horse, but I, at the start of each land use hearing, as a commissioner, I usually divulge to the audience that I'm on the board of directors of the Josephine Colonial Water Conservation District, which is which often comments on these land development matters. I do it just out of principle, but certainly that's far away from a financial. Should I go to all that trouble? Or
you know, I think it's a good idea.
Okay.
Especially once you've started that practice.
Yeah.
I think I'd continue to do it.
Right.
You know, as just because I'm, what's the right majority? I'm kind of a, I want to make sure that things are kind of always consistent. Why would you, what I do is prepare a little statement that you read and put it in the minutes every time. I don't want to, you know, add problems for you, but you said, you know, this is my statement of conflicts and, you know, abbreviate it, but you could submit something in the minutes. Because one of the things you're supposed to do on the disclosure is be able to prove that you disclosed. Right. And if it's not in the fact that one of the examples that they used today talked about, everybody admitted that he made a disclosure and the governing body said, well, yeah, we knew about that. But they couldn't find the tape and it wasn't in the minutes. And so they still sanctioned the guy, but they didn't find him anything, as I recall. I mean, it was like, bad boy, you need to be able to prove that. So the other thing I wanted to comment on real quick, and then I'm more than happy to talk about issues that you guys want to talk about, is the whole thing with the Robert's Rules of Order. If they are something that works and helps keep things going forward, great. Use them if you're comfortable with them. If they turn out to be more of a hindrance than they're worth, my suggestion is, man, if they're required in your bylaws, change your bylaws. Get rid of them. Throw them out. Because your object here is not to be parliamentarians at large, but land use planners. So, you know, if somebody's rising to points of objection, you know, when they have a personal privilege objection, you want to go to the bathroom. But don't get all wound around the axle on the technicalities of these kind of rules.
They are in the bylaws.
Yeah.
I looked that up to make sure. And that was something else that I know that Bob brings up every now and then is abstaining. And there's a different take on abstaining and voting. And I don't know if everybody has a clear understanding of abstaining from a vote. Because that doesn't that play into the quorum issue?
Well, it's been a long time since I've looked at that in the Robert's Rules of Orders. My recollection is, and I might have this back just mm-hmm. backwards, mm-hmm. but one of them said, you know, you can't abstain.
Right.
Okay. Well, my experience has been, you know, if you don't want to vote, I mean, I'm not going to vote. I either have a potential conflict or I feel like I may have a bias. Someone else says, no, you can't abstain. Well, yeah, I think I can. I'll take a look at that because I didn't remember that was in the bylaws.
Yeah, it's one of the old, it's real old. So
which version?
It's a very simple one. It was done back, I think, in the 60s or so, and I have a copy. I'll just scan it and email it to Pat for you.
So this bylaw is not a part of the RLDC. It's just a document that somebody found or you found?
It's not a part of the RLDC because this is when the Planning Commission was first formed. It's like the resolution. All of them are done with orders and resolutions.
Seems like we should have a copy of those so we can read them.
Right. Yeah. Well, they're not very lengthy. They're just one page, but they're very old.
One of the issues that we talked about with the describing when we're going to use the alternate, that could be an amendment to the bylaws. Use it that way, send it to the board and say, here's our practice and here's what we're doing, and if the board wants to give you a different direction, then you go from there.
Yeah, my experience with the board on these bylaws is that they want to facilitate your functioning. You know, they don't want to make it more difficult.
It's to me like if Robert Rules of Order is as confusing as I found it to be. And if you break some of Robert's rules during our hearings, somebody could potentially use it for a basis for an appeal. Maybe we ought to get rid of it.
Well, if
our own rules for hearings pulled from that, but maybe not
yeah,
Mark's talking about.
Because we really don't use the Roberts Rules of Order. We have a protocol that states how we address somebody that comes up to the podium, and there's definitely a written rule there of how that goes. Everybody is heard.
So I would point out, too, that if you don't comply with the Roberts Rules of Orders, somebody would have to show that they were prejudiced by you not doing that, and frankly, that would be difficult for somebody to do.
Okay, that's good.
Now, there are a couple of things, and one of them is failure to disclose the next party contact. That is an error straight up. They don't have to show prejudice in order to have the thing reversed. Now, obviously, at this level, if somebody takes appeal up to the commissioners, you know, the commissioners can cure an abundance of those procedural problems. And I've seen Luba say, well, you're complaining about something that happened at the Planning Commission. You appealed that to the Board of Commissioners. The commissioners, you know, disclose, you know, that somebody had put something that might have been ex parte in the record. You had an opportunity to rebut that, and you did or you didn't. It's not as fatal, frankly, at this level to the land use appeal process. But I think most of you want to do it right. I want to help you do it right. So those kind of things just need to be disclosed, and then there's no screaming and heartburn when it gets to the commissioners about, well, they didn't do it right.
Just one other question back on the first item about the non-voting member. I'm a little confused. It seems like this order here is very clear. You said just do whatever you do, be consistent.
Yeah.
But is it not clear?
It says
a non-voting member unless said alternate is substituting for an absent regular. So,
and that's what we did on the last meeting.
And that's what we should be.
Yeah. And I think that's why we came to the conclusion that we did.
Yeah. So
and that's why we did that when we did disclose that for the record. By the way, we did put that on the record. And there's another issue there that none of this really looks at, and that is an alternate needs to be trained. He needs time up there to be used to all of this. And if we never put an alternate up there, and wait for somebody to resign up here, we're not doing justice to that alternate and giving them time to get the experience that they need up there.
Yeah.
So anyway, I just wanted to throw that out. Dave, would you mind if I let Steve go ahead and go into this ex parte?
Sure.
Okay. Let me
volunteer to you this. You know, I know you've got another event scheduled here at 7:00. You want to spend more time on this, call me, coordinate that with Dave. I can be here, you know, and we can spend virtually as much time on this stuff as you want.
This has been a hot conversation with us here, so.
You want to stick to ex parte bias conflicts?
Yeah.
Steve, take it away.
Don't do it. Ex parte contacts are I think part of the problem is most people don't think of driving out past the site as an ex parte contact. I didn't talk to anybody. I just drove by the place and drove up. The road was bladed in, so I drove up there and I looked around and no contact with anybody. You had contact with the site. You got site impressions of the elevation, of how close it was to the neighbors, all kinds of stuff. Now, the way you cure an ex-party contact is to disclose. The problem with these ex-party contacts, in my opinion, especially as they relate to, you know, if somebody comes and says, hey, my neighbor's here, I want you to do this for my neighbor. I say, well, I'm sorry, I can't talk to you about that. That's an ex-party contact. You need to disclose that. There was a case a couple years ago where a commissioner said, Yeah, some guy, one of the parties to the proceedings said, I saw you at the restaurant over on 7th Street talking to the neighbor of the applicant. Yeah. Hell, you're right. I remember that. I hadn't even, yeah, you're right. So, well, what did you talk about? He said something about you ought to let this project move forward. I don't know. And Luba said, that was not an adequate disclosure. Well, I don't remember how I'm supposed to disclose. Stop and think about the things you don't remember when you drive up onto the site of a subdivision that you're looking at. Did you have a mental impression about the grade? I'll bet you did. Did you disclose what you thought the grade was? Because, see, they've got an opportunity. You have to give them the opportunity to rebut all the evidence and those site impressions that you took in. Now, I'm here to tell you that you probably all think I would do my job better if I had an idea about what it looked like, what the lay of the land was, and everything else. I know you would, but you're just creating problems for yourself. If you want to know what the exact slope is or the distance is or something else, you tell the applicant, I need this material. And they, you know, you can bring that up in the hearing. Hearing can be continued. I know you don't always want to do that, but it's an important thing. It might be in the staff report, or you might say, you know, that's not in the staff report, and I think, you know, we need to do that to comply with the criteria or whatever. If you drive out there on the site, you know, the best way to do it is to take everybody out there and tell them, we're going out to the site. That is cumbersome and sometimes expensive. And chances of everybody getting together at the same time, most of you have something to do during the day, I assume.
No, I think we wouldn't be here.
Well, okay. But I mean, that's hard to do. So if you can restrain yourselves from having those, because most of you would recognize if an applicant or one of the pro or con on the issue came up and started saying, hey, you know, they didn't tell you this, and you need to know that, and you say, you know, I really can't talk to you about that. And then your disclosure can be real simple. And I was approached by, I don't know their name, and were in favor of the project. I told them I couldn't talk to it. That was the sum and substance. That was the end of it. And then you kind of cured your problem.
So even a drive-by on a where you stay on the public street, you don't actually enter the site, either with or without permission. That's still ex parte contact.
Did you see the site?
Yes.
Did you get any impressions from those sites?
Well, probably. Yeah.
Well, I'd say yes.
Ex parte contact.
Yeah.
I did not know that.
And if you disclose that, I mean, there is in that handout that I gave to you a section in there about what do you do to cure the ex parte contact. You make disclosure. You tell them what you saw.
I drive past it every day.
I drive past that every day. That intersection is where I get on to come into town every day, or at least 5-6 times a week. That's all you really need to do to disclose if it's something that you're literally driving by on a daily basis. One of the real problems occurs is where after the hearing is closed, and you're going to deliberate now, the hearing's closed, and for some reason, deliberations are continued. For whatever reason, it's not done right now, and you say, okay, well, the hearing's closed, so there's no problem. I'm just going to drive by on the way home. Oh, man, now the record's closed, but you're still taking in those site impressions of the problem. So now when you come back, you got to make the disclosure. And then you got to open the hearing up again, because they've got an opportunity to rebut. So, like I said, I know it sounds kind of dumb and counterintuitive again, but it's just easier if you don't expose yourself to site visits and ex-parte contacts.
How about if it's a public record?
If it's a public record and it's not before
or,
you,
I'll take that right now. Public, but it's available. Media, like Google Earth, I can tell how many plot plants you got in your backyard.
Can you just close it? You know, I'm looking for the site on Google Earth. I think the summary that they have in the materials I handed out about what you need to disclose or to cure is pretty simple. You say, you know, I was curious about this site. I went on Google Earth. Now, if there's topographical lines on that, well, you better disclose that because sometimes those are wrong. And the Kim family could tell you how long the map quest is sometimes. But the point of fact is that should be coming by way of engineer or surveyor testimony at that podium. You shouldn't be out there driving and making your elevations and shots from what your own site impressions.
And that should be part of the staff report too. And you know, Roger and I both tried to give you a pretty good visual picture in writing that staff report. And the applicant, if they're a good applicant, and several of them are, they try to give you a good impression of that too. I wanted to pose a question.
Can I make one more point about the contacts, ex parte contacts? A lot of times an applicant or one of the pro-comp people say, well, you were talking to the lawyer, or you were talking to the planning director, or you were talking to the staff. Yeah, that's not ex parte contact. You talk with your lawyer, a memorandum to somebody from the planning staff, or I, as the legal counsel, submit to you, is not ex parte contact. So I say that just because sometimes people kind of recoil. Well, I didn't mean to do anything wrong. You're not doing anything wrong when you talk with staff.
That's my question.
Oh, okay. Really?
That was going to be
my
okay.
It is counterintuitive to me, but I follow your logic, and it makes sense. But one of the problems I see is we'll get testimony from neighbors saying, I remember a specific case, one of the people at the table will remember it too. The neighbor said there was like 500 truckloads of logs growing on that property. And the applicant said, just wouldn't even grow trees. The forester said it wouldn't grow trees. Testified to that. Now, we're listening to two or three people say it's just like the most beautiful virgin forest in the world, and two or three others saying nothing will grow. If we can't even go look at it, and the applicant's opponents can't send experts to contradict the applicant's experts, we're kind of stuck in a bind. And I don't know if this has any play on your consideration at all, but I sent letters out to suggestions to the commissioners, the board of commissioners, that every board of commissioners in the state, all 35 or all but one, goes to me. Every one of them that answered, which was 15, said, absolutely. Either we encourage it or we allow it. All of them.
Well, then they're wrong. I mean, you can see the statutes in the case law that's sorted in it. Here's the issue with stuff like that, in my opinion. If I'm not familiar with the case that you're talking about, or if I am, I don't recognize it. If somebody says, oh, that property will grow all kinds of trees. Well, really? Where's your proof?
Well, they had some. They were showing stumpies. Remember they had pictures of stumpies there? Measured it?
But how do we know where the stumps were?
Yeah, we don't. But that was
the point.
Well, and you're always able to say, you know, I didn't find that testimony credible.
How do we know if we can't?
You're the fact.
What if there's two credible witnesses and three young guys?
Well, then who has the burden of proof?
The applicant.
Yeah. I mean, that's the rub. Is that
it just seems like it'd be so simple when you get totally conflicting testimony that we go, okay, we want to go see for ourselves because, well, somebody's lying.
Okay, but let's work through that scenario. The applicant says that property won't go with trees. Okay, so he's got a forester who says, soil guy, that probably won't grow trees. And you get somebody else who shows up with pictures of stumps. Where was that taken? Well, it was right there. So you were trespassing?
Yes, I was.
Actually, I think they were taking pictures supposedly from the fence line.
I guess.
Burn the proof.
Where does that, brought to Mark? You believe me or your lying eyes? You know, I mean, somebody can take a photo, and frankly, with Photoshop and everything else that can use nowadays.
Sure.
I mean, me personally, I'd be more inclined to take the word of an expert forester or geologist and say, you know, this soil may have gotten standard timber off of this once in the last 200 years, but there isn't going to be any more marketable timber there for another 150. And somebody else says, oh, yeah, there's lots of trees here. Look at all these stumps. And frankly, you're in the unenviable position of saying, we're the finder of fact. We didn't find this credible. We did find that credible. And that's the way we go. I mean, for you to go out and wander around, unless you're an engineer or a geologist or a timber spruiser guy, what are you going to say?
Well, another example is when somebody saw there's a live stream running through that property, the applicant says, there's not water anywhere on this property. Well, I can walk out and see if there's a live stream or not.
Well, what proof does the person, the witness, offer you that there's a live stream?
This is more hypothetical than anything else. I've heard some stuff about springs, and I don't remember what proof that they had. I don't even remember how significant it was. But the applicants have their experts are paid by the applicant, so they're a little questionable right there to me. Because I have hired people who have done some pretty strange things without me knowing it, like test pits 6 feet deep, and I go on the property and where are they? It's my property. I don't see any test pits, but thanks.
Well, I mean, you raise an interesting point about how you evaluate a professional's testimony and a neighbor who may be 100% opposed to this project and decide, you know, who has the bias. That's why you, as the fact finder, get to weigh that testimony and say, you know what, I got one guy over here, he's got 3 days of experience as a hydrologist or whatever, and I got 12 neighbors saying, there's no water on this property out here. Who are you going to go with? Maybe the 12 neighbors, even though they don't have, you know, as much scientific background. The flip side is, you got a guy who's been doing this for 30 years. He's going to be in here again tomorrow, hired by another applicant to do another piece of property.
And he has a license to lose.
Yeah, he's got a license to lose, and his credibility, if it's shot with this group, how marketable is he? As opposed to the guy who just doesn't want the project to go forward at all, no matter what.
In a nutshell, it sounds like we shouldn't do any research other than what's in the background.
You know, the fact of the matter is, you are to be an impartial tribunal set up in a quasi-judicial setting. I mean, what would you say if the judge said, now let me go and do some research on that, because I know what your witness says, but I'm not going to tell you when I'm going to go out there, by the way. I'm just going to go out and do a little research, collect a little evidence, and then I'm going to make my decision based on that.
Well, but the judge has the defendant and the prosecutor, if it's a criminal issue, that are both allowed to go and do all the independent research they want to and report.
Or not so. The prosecutor doesn't have the right to depose, you know, the defendant. Defendant can sit there and remain silent.
Right.
What I'm telling you is that there are always adjustments and balances that are made between the rights at play. And I don't have to have, 47 neighbors come trump on my property. I simply have the burden of proof to show you, either with my own photos, my own testimony, of the testimony of experts.
So if I apply for a building permit, can I say, sorry, you can't own that property, Mr. Building Inspector, because I don't want people to drop on that property?
I don't think he gives sign off on the final.
He can probably deny him the right to do it, but you really won't sign off.
So, I mean, it's like, cut your nose off.
Okay, anything else?
I think I addressed the issue of conflict. Is it financial? Under the Oregon definition of what's a conflict, it's always got to involve a pecuniary interest. And so it's really pretty easy to identify, and the actual and the potential is just it could as opposed to it would. If it would benefit you, you know, then you got a straight up actual conflict, and you can't participate. That is different from the bias, or, I mean, they use some weird expression which I'd never even heard before. I think they call it predetermination. It's not bias, it's predetermination. You've already made up your mind. And in a legislative hearing, you can do that. You say, yeah, at the commissioner level, you said, you're right, I campaigned. That was one of my campaign issues. I have a legislative bias. I have a policy preference. And I'm going to do everything I can to make sure that my policy preferences are reflected in the land use plan or whatever it is, because they're legislative. But in a quasi-judicial function where you're taking a specific set of criteria and applying it to a specific property for the specific applicant, well, now you've got to do that quasi-judicial role and be fair and impartial. And so if they do say, well, you have a bias, first of all, they've got the burden to prove that you have a bias. They say, well, you've said you don't think there's enough industrial land in Josephine County, therefore you're biased. Well, no. I mean, that's my thinking, but I'm certainly willing to be persuaded otherwise, or I'm willing to listen to both sides before I make a decision. You have basically made a comment, made a disclosure or not disclosed. I don't think I'm biased at all. I did say that. That newspaper did quote me. Another thing, newspaper articles, ex parte. So if you read an article in the paper and you're making decisions based on that, it's an ex parte contact. Just disclose that you read that article.
That just tells that I subscribe to the Courier.
Yeah. No. Yeah, I read that article in the paper, but set that aside and take my decision.
Do you read?
But on the bias stuff, all you need to do is if somebody challenges you, okay, you challenge me, I'm telling you I'm not biased, I'm telling you I can be fair. At the commissioner level, you know, if one member is about to be biased by the other, you know, then the issue comes up about whether they can screen them off the participation. I don't even, frankly, have never researched whether that's true. If everybody else says, oh, yeah, you're biased, then they ask you to step down or step back. But that's a different issue. And the remedy is different from conflict. Conflicts involve money. So, for example, if you're negotiating to buy a piece of property while you're voting to split that thing out into X number of lots, then you got a straight up actual conflict. And you'll not only screw up the land use process, but you'll subject yourself to financial fines from the Ethics Commission. And that's kind of the big distinction between bias and conflict. And you had one other recusal?
Recusal was on there last year. And also, Mike talked about
Let me address that one first because it's the easiest to do. Appearance of conflict, interestingly enough, in Oregon is no problem. Washington has codified an appearance of conflict rule. So if it looks bad in Washington, you got to pull out. In Oregon, it's like, no, I don't care what it looks like. Now, obviously, you have to be the judge of that. I mean, you know, you want to maintain some sense by everybody that you're being fair and impartial. And if it looks bad enough, you know, maybe discretion is that you bow out. But you're not required to by law. They just simply haven't adopted any requirements for avoiding the appearance. You know, there may be a policy that you guys have, and the board encourages you to, you know, let's make it look, you know, as clean, as open as we can. I know this isn't a problem, but this is how we want to go. That's different, though, than saying you can't do that. So the other issue on recusal, the only thing I would say on that is when you elect not to participate, and frankly, there's enough members here that it doesn't usually come up. But the applicant is entitled to a decision. So if it's, you know, 3-3 and one guy abstains at the Planning Commission level, that's going to be treated as a denial. Okay? He's applied for something, he didn't get it, it's a denial. When it goes on up to the commissioners, if it goes up to the commissioners, and by the way, for that reason, I would encourage you, unless there's a bona fide legal requirement that you abstain, don't do it. I mean, vote, because if either side, if they don't like it, can appeal it. And that way, the applicant either gets his decision, good or bad. I mean, if you say no bad, you can't do that, at least he gets the right to appeal. And the flip side is too true for the people that are in opposition to the applicant. At the level, at the commissioner's level, if it's a tie, 2-2, or 1-1, and one of them abstains, Luba has said that's a denial. You know, the arguments come up every once in a while, no, that's just no decision. That's not a denial. Well, no, Luba says a person is entitled to a decision. You have to make a decision, and if it's deadlocked, we're just going to treat that as a denial, so the person will have the right to appeal then, if they choose to Luba.
Interesting.
So a person that's an applicant should always hope to get a full board of commissioners, or it's really kind of stacked against them. Because he loses a 1-1 vote.
Yeah, he does.
Right? But
yeah.
If there's three commissioners, the chances are he might get a 1-2.
Yeah. I've seen some of those.
So for a commissioner's voting record, if they're concerned about that, they can always say, look, I didn't vote no on that item. I just abstained and the item failed.
The final result is really bad.
Yeah.
And he's going to show up.
And that's the net effect of a tie is a denial.
Right.
And the rationale is the vote.
We've only got a few minutes left. I want to kind of blow through some of this if we can. Turning to Exhibit A, I'm going to make reference to other exhibits. Under motions, you might write in the margin there, see Exhibit D. It's on the simplified Robert's Rules of Order.
No, B is in boy.
B? B is in boy.
Did you say B is in boy or D is in...
So D is in dog. There are some treatment of motions there. So you might want to read that for background. And just quickly put in the expanded outline. Just state clearly and succinctly what your motion is for the record. We have it recorded. We also have Anna's recording secretary, so we need to know what that motion really is. A valid motion is not to say, well, I disagree with everything the Malcolm said, and that's my motion. Well, specifically, how do you agree with that's not a motion. You need to say what the motion is. What are you really throwing on the table? Because the rest of you need to know what you're voting on. Address the issues and conditions discussed. One idea is between commission discussion, if the chair is having an idea that this might be complicated, any motion maybe just isn't a thumbs up, thumbs down. There may be conditions that you want to propose with your motion. It's a good idea to take a 5-minute recess and write down those conditions. You could read them into the record. Stan did that in a recent hearing where he asked, do you want to take a 5-minute break? And maybe he didn't explain what he meant by that, but that's what he was after. To say, why don't we take time to collect our thoughts, write down our proposed motions, and then come back and go through it.
It's very important to have good, solid motions.
Right.
Because everything is stacked on top of that.
Right.
And if we don't do that, if it's not clear, per records are clear, try to figure out what had been done. I thought that 5 minutes was an excellent idea, but I think we all took it as a recess, a break. We were going to get up and go have a drink of water or something.
It's really to collect your thoughts, and to avoid any potential of an ex parte contact on your way out to the restroom or to get a drink of water or wander outside and look at the moon and think about your motion, I would encourage you probably to take that 5 minutes to sit there at the dais, collect your thoughts, review your notes, and use it for that purpose. Also, being clear when moving and seconding, as Don mentioned, so the record's very clear. The chair will repeat the motion before the roll call, so everyone knows what they're voting on. If there's clarification needed, that's the time to stop the presses and clarify it. We'll do roll call by secretary for the motions. Findings is a pretty important topic, and we don't have a lot of time to discuss that, but I want to encourage you to think about the word because. If you're making a motion, why are you doing it? I think this application should be approved because. And then you state what those reasons are, based on the staff report, based on the applicable code, and based upon the testimony of the applicant and others. I find this application meets the standards of the RLDC and therefore should be approved. That's a finding.
Without having to use the word, these are my findings. Say that
yeah, way. But it's what you're stating, the reasons behind what you're voting. Not, I like this application, I want to approve it. That's not a finding. So, is it based on the code? Is it based on testimony? Is it based on the application materials?
There may be occasions in the findings where you'll want to make a finding that we find this expert much more credible than that expert. And those are the things that you need to put in the findings. So, well, why did, you know, they had two experts here, and why didn't they address both of them? If you just say, we found them more credible, we found them more persuasive. His degree is in something specific, and this other guy is just a civil engineer.
Are you talking about an expert for the applicant or an expert for an opponent?
Yeah. I'm talking about anything that has to do with your findings.
I mean, we're not going to be an expert for the opponent because he can't go on the property, right? So we're all only hearing one side.
Well, that's not true.
No, you're hearing
Both sides.
They're experts because they can't analyze the actual conditions on the ground unless they're trespassing.
Like soil, for instance.
Soil, tree growth.
Taking plugs from the trees for seeing how many rings are in them, how long it takes to grow.
Well, I mean, I've seen foresters testify that, you know, that they check the whole side of the hill, not on that 20-acre piece, but around here, and this is what they're getting. And you are entitled to say, you know, I find that a lot more persuasive than the hired gun who comes in here and says, no, this is my findings regarding 20 acres. And you're entitled to say, as the fact finder, you know, I just don't find that credible.
I don't believe that. Sure.
I haven't seen that sort of thing. You know, you get people that have knowledge, maybe not based on a recent site visit, but on other kinds of experiences. Someone who was a surveyor.
Yeah.
Who tromped all over that area. I wasn't testifying as an expert forester, but because he's a surveyor, had been on the property or had been on adjacent properties and had testimony to give.
Yeah, I haven't seen that yet, but I could see that it could come up.
We've had a couple instances where we've had some experts licensed testify that were flat out unbelievably uncredible, and their testimony didn't hold a lot of weight.
We're 5 minutes away from our hearing, so I would like to maybe wrap this and just encourage you to read the comments under conduct during hearing on Exhibit A. The chit chat is essentially qualifies a couple of things. It could be a contact that's outside of the hearing process that needs to be for everyone. And I think cell phones and BlackBerry and text messages, things like that are pretty obvious. But read the notes if you have any questions.
What about asking questions of the people sitting beside you at the table? I find you're lying and disrespectful to whoever's talking or testifying, but it happens.
Well, there could be an instance. Here's an example. It's like I could lean to Malcolm, but do you remember seeing the statement in the packet?
Where's that in the statement?
Yeah.
That sort of thing.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. Sometimes we'll lose it.
I think you're fine there. A discussion about the merits of the application between two commission members.
Absolutely.
Away from the microphone, that's another.
Yeah, I just want to make sure that there is clarification where there is times where that's valid to ask the guy next to you.
Something. Well, and I think if something like that, it's maybe always appropriate to ask the chairman, Mr. Chairman, I didn't hear that, or I missed that, or I'm not sure where we are on the staff report. And that way everybody knows what that conversation is rather than, what are those guys down there about?
Rather than turning to your
neighbor. We're
going
to have to cut this off here.
I'd like to thank Mr. Reed for coming over and
spending
this time with us.
Thank you.
Very fruitful.
Come back.
We'll have you back.
Thanks, Steve.